Monstro by Junot Diaz. At first, Negros thought it funny. A disease that could make a Haitian blacker? It was the joke of the year. Everybody in our sector accusing everybody else of having it. You couldn't display a blemish or catch some sun on the street without the joke starting. Somebody would point to a spot on your arm and say, Diablo, Haitiano, ¿qué te pasó? La negrura, they called it. The darkness. These days, everybody wants to know what you were doing when the world came to an end. Fools make up all sorts of vainglorious, self-serving plep, but me, I tell the truth. I was chasing a girl. I was one of the idiots who didn't heed any of the initial reports, who got caught way out there. What can I tell you? My head just wasn't into any mysterious disease. Not with my mom sick and all. Not with Misty. Motherfuckers used to say Kulo would be the end of us. Well, for me, it really was. In the beginning, the doctor types couldn't wrap their brains around it either. The infection showed up on a small boy in the relocation camps outside Port-au-Prince in the hottest March in recorded history. The index case was only 4 years old, and by the time his uncle brought him in, his arm looked like an enormous black pustule. So huge, it had turned the boy into an appendage of the arm. In the glypts, he looked terrified. Within a month, a couple of thousand more infections were reported. Didn't rip through the Pobla like the dengues or the poxes. More of a slow, leprous spread. A black mold fungus blast that came on like a splotch and then gradually started taking you over, tunneling right through you. Though, as it turned out, it wasn't a mold fungus blast at all. It was something else. Something new. Everybody blamed the heat. Blamed the calientazo. Shit. 100 straight days over 105 degrees Fahrenheit in our region alone. The planet cooking like a chimney. And down to its last 5 trees. Something berserk was bound to happen. All sorts of bizarre outbreaks already in play. Diseases no one had names for. Zoonotics by the pound. This one didn't cause too much panic because it seemed to hit only the sickest of the sick, victims who had 9 kinds of ill already in them. You literally had to be falling to pieces for it to grab you. It almost always started epidermically and then worked its way up and in. Most of the infected were immobile within a few months, the worst comatose by 6. Strangest thing, though, once infected, few victims died outright. They just seemed to linger on and on. Coral reefs might have been adios on the ocean floor, but they were alive and well on the arms and backs and heads of the infected. Black, rotting, rugose masses fruiting out of bodies. The medicos formed a 90-nation consortium, flooded one another with papers and hypotheses, ran every test they could afford, but not even the military enhancers could crack it. In the early months, there was a big make-do because it was so strange and because no one could identify the route of transmission. That got the big heads more worked up than the disease itself. There seemed to be no logic to it. Spouses in constant contact didn't catch the negrura, but some unconnected fool on the other side of the camp did. A huge rah-rah. But when the experts determined that it wasn't communicable in the standard ways and that normal immune systems appeared to be at no kind of risk, the renminbi and the attention and the savvy went elsewhere. And since it was just poor Haitian types getting fucked up, no real margin in that. Once the initial bulla died down, only a couple of underfunded teams stayed on. As for the infected, all the medicos could do was try to keep them nourished and hydrated. And more important, prevent them from growing together. That was a serious issue. The blast seemed to have a boner for fusion, respected no kind of boundaries. I remember the first time I saw it on the wall. Alex was like, Mira esta vaina, almost delighted. A shaky glimpse of a pair of naked, trembling Haitian brothers sharing a single stained cot, knotted together by horrible mold, their heads slurred into one. About the nastiest thing you ever saw. Misty saw it and looked away, and eventually I did too. My tios were like, Somebody needs to drop a bomb on those people. And even though I was one of the pro-Haitian domos, at the time I was thinking it might have been a mercy. I was actually on the island when it happened. Front row fucking seat. How lucky was that? They call those of us who made it through time witnesses. I can think of a couple of better terms. I'd come down to the DR because my mother had got super sick. The year before, she'd been bitten by a rupture virus that tore through half her organs before the doctors got savvy to it. No chance she was going to be taken care of back north. Not with what the cheapest nurses charged. So she rented out the Brooklyn house to a bunch of Mexos, took that loot, and came home. Better that way. Say what you want, but family on the island was still more reliable for heavy shit, like, say, dying, than family in the north. Medicine was cheaper, too. With the flying territory in Haina, its Chinese factories pumping out pharma like it was a Romo, growing organ sheets by the mile, and for somebody as sick as my mother, with only rental income to live off, being there was what made sense. I was supposed to be helping out, but really I didn't do nah for her. My tia Olivia had it all under control, and if you want the truth, I didn't feel comfortable hanging around the house with Mom all sick. The vieja could barely get up to piss, looked like a stick version of herself. Hard to see that. If I stayed an hour with her, it was a lot. What an asshole, right? What a shallow motherfucker. But I was 19, and what is 19 if not for shallow? In any case, my mother didn't want me around either. It made her sad to see me so uncomfortable. And what could I do for her besides wring my hands? She had Livia, she had her nurse, she had the muchacha who cooked and cleaned. I was only in the way. Maybe I'm just saying this to cover my failings as a son. Maybe I'm saying this because of what happened. Maybe. Go, have fun with your friends, she said behind her breathing mask. Didn't have to tell me twice. Fact is, I wouldn't have come to the island that summer if I'd been able to nab a job or an internship. But the droughts that year and the general economic collapse meant that nobody was nabbing shit. Even the sovereign kids were ending up home with their parents. So with the house being rented out from under me and nowhere else to go, not even a girlfriend to mooch off, I figured, fuck it. Might as well spend the hots on the island. Take in some of that old-time climate change. Get to know the patria again. For 6-7 months, it was just a horrible Haitian disease. Who fucking cared, right? A couple of hundred new infections each month in the camps and around Port-au-Prince. Pocket change, really. Nowhere near what Crimea was doing to the Russian hinterlands. For a while, it was nothing. Nothing at all. And then some real eerie pleb started happening. Doctors began reporting a curious change in the behavior of the infected patients. They wanted to be together, in close proximity, all the time. They no longer tolerated being separated from other infected, started coming together in the main quarantine zone, just outside Champ de Mars, the largest of the relocation camps. All the victims seemed to succumb to this ingathering compulsion. Some went because they claimed they felt safer in the quarantine zone. Others just picked up and left without a word to anyone, trekked halfway across the country as though following a homing beacon. Once victims got it in their heads to go, no dissuading them, left family, friends, children behind, walked out on wedding days, on swell business. Once they were in the zone, nothing could get them to leave. When authorities tried to distribute the infected victims across a number of centers, they either wouldn't go or made their way quickly back to the main zone. One doctor from Martinique, his curiosity piqued, isolated an elderly victim from the other infected and took her to a holding bay some distance outside the main quarantine zone. Within 24 hours, this frail septuagenarian had torn off her heavy restraints, broken through a mesh security window, and crawled halfway back to the quarantine zone before she was recovered. Same doctor performed a second experiment, helicoptered two infected men to a hospital ship offshore. As soon as they were removed from the quarantine zone, they went batshit, trying everything they could to break free, to return. No sedative or entreaty proved effective, and after 4 days of battering themselves relentlessly against the doors of their holding cells, the men loosed a last high-pitched shriek and died within minutes of each other. Stranger shit was in the offing. 8 months into the epidemic, all infected victims, even the healthiest, abruptly stopped communicating. Just went silent. Nothing abnormal in their blood work or in their scans. They just stopped talking. Friends, family, doctors, it didn't matter. No stimuli of any form could get them to speak. watched everything and everyone, clearly understood commands and information, but refused to say anything. Anything human, that is. Shortly after the silence, the phenomenon that came to be known as the chorus began. The entire infected population simultaneously let out a bizarre shriek, 2-3 times a day, starting together, ending together. Talk about unnerving. Even patients who'd lost their faces chewed off by the blast joined in, the vibrations rising out of the excrescence itself. Even the patients who were comatose never lasted more than 20-30 seconds. Eerie siren shit. No uninfected could stand to hear it, but uninfected kids seemed to be the most unsettled. After a week of that wailing, the majority of kids had fled the areas around the quarantine zone, moved to other camps. That should have alerted someone, but who paid attention to camp kids? Brain scans performed during the outbursts actually detected minute fluctuations in the infected patient's biomagnetic signals, but unfortunately for just about everybody on the planet, these anomalies were not pursued. There seemed to be more immediate problems. There were widespread rumors that the infected were devils, even reports of relatives attempting to set their infected family members on fire. In my sector, my mom and my tia were about the only people paying attention to any of it. Everybody else was obsessing over what was happening with Crimea. Mom and tia Olivia felt bad for our poor West Coast neighbors. They were churchy like that. When I came back from my outings, I'd say, fooling, "How are los explotao?" And my mother would say, "It's not funny, hijo." "She's right," Aunt Olivia said. "That could be us next, and then you won't be joking." So what was I doing, if not helping my mom or watching the apocalypse creep in? Like I told you, I was chasing a girl. And I was running around the island with this hijo de mami y papi I knew from Brown. Living prince because of him, basically. Classy, right? My mater stuck in darkness, with the mosquitoes 50 to a finger and the heat like the inside of a tailpipe. And there I was, privando Enrico inside the dome, where the bafflers held the scorch to a breezy 82 degrees Fahrenheit, and one mosquito a night was considered an invasion. I hadn't actually planned on rolling with Alex that summer. It wasn't like we were close friends or anything. We ran in totally different circles back at Brown. Him prince, me prole. But we were both from the same little island that no one else in the world cared about, and that counted for something, even in those days. On top of that, we were both art types, which in our world of hyper-capitalism was like having a serious mental disorder. He was already making dough on his photography, and I was attracting no one to my writing. But he had always told me, "Hit me up the next time you come down." So before I flew in, I glipped at him, figuring he wasn't going to respond, and he glipped it right back. "What's going on, Charlotte, and cuando vamos a hanguiar?" And that's basically all we did until the end. Hanguiar. I knew nobody in the DR outside of my crazy cousins, and they didn't like to do anything but watch the fights, play dominoes, and fuck. Which is fine for maybe a week, but for 3 months? No, hombre. I wasn't that island. For Alex did me a solid by putting me on. More than a solid. Saved my ass full. Dude scooped me up from the airport in his father's burner, looking so fit it made me want to drop and do 20 on the spot. "Welcome to the country of Las Maravillas," he said with a snort, waving his hand at all the thousands of non-treaty motos on the road, the banners for the next election punching you in the face everywhere. Took me over to the rooftop apartment his dad had given him in the rebuilt Zona Colonial. The joint was a metaglass palace that overlooked the drowned sectors, full of his photographs and all the bric-a-brac he had collected for props, with an outdoor deck as large as an aircraft carrier. "You live here?" I said. And he shrugged lazily, until Papi decides to sell the building. One of those moments when you realize exactly how rich some of the kids you go to school with are. Without even thinking about it, he glipted me a 6-month VIP pass for the dome, which cost about a year's tuition. "Just in case," he said. He'd been on island since before the semester ended. "A month here and I'm already a plata now," he complained. "I think I'm losing my ability to read." We drank some more Spike, and some of his too-cool-for-school dome friends came over, slim, tall, and wealthy. everyone doing double takes when they saw the size of me and heard my dark accent. But Alex introduced me as his brown classmate. A genius, he said, and that made it a little better. What do you do? They asked, and I told them I was trying to be a journalist, which for that set was like saying I wanted to molest animals. I quickly became part of the furniture, one of Alex's least interesting photos. Don't you love my friends? Alex said. Son tan amable. That first night I kinda had been hoping for a go club, or something bananas like that. But it was a talk and spike and let's look at Alex's latest photos type party. What redeemed everything for me was that around midnight, one last girl came up the corkscrew staircase. Alex said loudly, "Look who's finally here," and a girl shouted, "I was at church, coño," which got everybody laughing. Because of the weak light, I didn't get a good look at first. Just the hair and the vampire steak heels. Then she finally made it over, and I saw the cut on her and the immensity of those eyes, and I was like, fuck me. That girl? With one fucking glance, she upended my everything.
So you're the friend. I'm Misty.
Her crafted eyes giving me the once-over. And you're in this country voluntarily? A ridiculously beautiful Mina wafting up a metal corkscrew staircase in high heels and offering up her perfect cheek as the light from the dome was dying out across the city. That I could have withstood. But then she spent the rest of the night ribbing me because I was so Americanized, because my Spanish sucked, because I didn't know any of the island things they were talking about, and that was it for me. I was lost. Everybody at school knew Alex. Shit, I think everybody in Providence knew him. Negro was star like that. This flash priv kid who looked more like an Uruguayan football player than a platano, with short, curly Praetorian hair and machine-made cheekbones, and about the greenest eyes you ever saw. 6'8" and super full of himself. Threw the sickest parties, always stepping out with the most rompin' girls. Drove an Eastwood, for fuck's sake. But what I realized on the island was that Alex was more than just a Rico. Turned out he was a fucking V. Son of the wealthiest, most privved-up family on the island. His abuelo like the 99th richest man in the Americas, while his abuela had more than 9,000 properties. At Brown, Negro had actually been playing it modest, for good reason, too. Turned out that when homeboy was in middle school, he was kidnapped for 8 long months, barely got out alive. Never talked about it, not even cryptically. But dude never left the house in DR unless he was packing fuego. Always offered me a cannon, too, like it was a piece of fruit or something. Said, just, you know, in case something happens. V or not, I had respect for Alex, because he worked hard as a fuck. Not one of those upper-class vividos who sat around and blew lax. Was doing philosophy at Brown and business at MIT. Smashed like a 4.0 and still had time to do his photography thing. And unlike a lot of our laxsters in the States, he really loved his Santo Domingo. Never pretended he was Spanish or Italian or gringo. Always claimed Dominicano. And that ain't nothing. Not the way platanos can be. For all his pluses, Alex could also be extra dickish. Always had to be the center of attention. I couldn't say anything slightly smart without him wanting to argue with me. And when you got him on a point, he huffed, "Well, I don't know about that." Treated Dominican workers in restaurants and clubs and bars like they were lower than shit. Never left any kind of tip. "You have to yell at these people or they'll just walk all over you," was his whole thing. "Yeah, right, Alex," I told him. And he grimaced. "You're just a Naxalite, and you're just a come solo," I said, which he hated. Pretty much on his own. No siblings, and his family was about as checked out as you could get. Had a dad who spent so much time abroad that Alex would have been lucky to pick him out in a lineup. And a mom who'd had more plastic surgery than all of Caracas combined, who flew out to Miami every week just to shop and fuck the Senegalese lawyer that everybody except the dad seemed to know about. Alex had a girlfriend from his social set he'd been dating since they were 12, Valentina. Had cheated on her at least 2,000 times, with girls and boys, but because of his locks, she wasn't going anywhere. Dude told me all about it, too, as soon as he introduced me to her. "What do you think of that?" he asked me, with a serious cheese on his face. "Sounds pretty shitty," I said.
Oh, come on, he said, putting an avuncular arm around me. It ain't that bad. Alex's big dream? Of course, we all knew it because he wouldn't shut up about all the plep he was going to do. He wanted to be either the Dominican Sebastián Salgado or the Dominican Juan Silva, minus the double amputation, Natch. But he also wanted to write novels, make films, drop an album, be the star of a channel on the world. Dude wanted to do everything. As long as it was arty and it made him a name, he was into it. He was also the one who wanted to go to Haiti, to take pictures of all the infected people. Misty was like, you can go catch a plague all by your fool self, but he waved her off and recited his motto, which was also on his cards, to represent, to surprise, to cause, to provoke. To die, she added. He shrugged, smiled his 100 crore smile. A photographer has to be willing to risk it all. A photograph can change todo. He had to hand it to him. He had confidence. And recklessness. I remember this time a farmer in Bani uncovered an unexploded bomb from the Civil War in his field. Alex raced us all out there and wanted to take a photo of Misty sitting on the device in a cheerleading outfit. She was like, are you insane? So he sat down on it himself while we crouched behind the burner, and he snapped his own picture, grinning like a loon, first with a Leica, then with a Polaroid. Got on the front page of Listin with that antic. Parents flying in from their respective cities to have a chat with him. He really did think he could change Toto. Me, I didn't want to change nada. I didn't want to be famous. I just wanted to write one book that was worth a damn, and I would have happily called it a day. Mi hermano, that's pathetic to an extreme, Alex said. You have to dream a lot bigger than that. Well, I certainly dreamed big with Misty. In those days, she was my Wonder Woman, my Queen of Jaragua. But the truth is, I don't remember her as well as I used to. Don't have any pictures of her. They were all lost in the fall when the memory stacks blew, when La Capitale was scoured. One thing a negro wasn't going to forget, though, one thing that you didn't need photos for, was how beautiful she was. Tall and copper-colored, with a Stradivarius curve to her back. An ex-volleyball player studying international law at Unibe, with a cascade of black hair you could have woven 30 Days of Nights from. Some modeling when she was 13, 14. Definitely on the receiving end of some skin crafting and bone crafting, maybe breasts, definitely ass, and who knows what else. But would rather have died than cop to it. You better believe I'm pura lemba, she always said, and even I had to roll my eyes at that. Don't roll your eyes at me. I am. Spent 5 years in Quebec before her mother finally dumped her asshole Canadian stepfather and dragged her back screaming to La Capitale, something she still held against the Vieja, against the whole DR. Spoke impeccable French and used it every chance she got. Always made a show of reading thick-ass French novels like La Cousine Bette, and that was what she wanted once her studies were over, to move to Paris, work for the UN, read French books in a café. Men love me in Paris, she announced, like this might be a revelation. Men love you here, Alex said, shook her head. It's not the same. Of course it's not the same, I said. Men shower in Santo Domingo, and dance, too. You ever see franceses dance? It's like watching an epileptics convention. Misty spat an ice cube at me. Frenchmen are the best. Yes, she liked me well enough. Could even say we were friends. I had my charming in those days. I had a mouth on me like all the swords of the Montagues and Capulets combined. Like someone had overdosed me with truth serum. You're Alex's only friend who doesn't take his crap, she once confided. You don't even take my crap. Yes, she liked me, but she didn't like me, entiendes? But God did I love her. Not that I had any idea how to start with a girl like her. The only us time we ever had was when Alex sent her to pick me up, and she'd show up either at my house in Villacon or at the gym. My crazy cousins got so excited. They weren't used to seeing a fresa like her. She knew what she was doing. She'd leave her driver out front and come into the gym to fetch me, put on a real show. I always knew she'd arrived because the whole gravity of the gym would shift to the entrance, and I'd look over from my workout, and there she'd be. Never had any kind of game with her. Best I could do on our rides to where Alex was waiting was ask her about her day, and she always said the same thing. Terrible. They had a mighty strange relationship, Alex and Misty did. She seemed pissed off at him at least 80% of the time. But she was also always with him. And it seemed to me that Alex spent more time with Misty than he did with Valentina. Misty helped him with all his little projects, and yet she never seemed happy about it. Always acted like it was this massive imposition. "Jesus, Alex," she said, "will you just make it already?" Acted like everything he did bored her. That, I've come to realize, was her protective screen, to always appear bored. Even when she wasn't bored, Misty wasn't easy. Heva had a temper, always blowing up on Alex because he said something or was late or because she didn't like the way he laughed at her. Blew up on me if I ever sided with him. Called him a mama huevo at least once a day, which in the old DR was a pretty serious thing to throw at a guy. Alex didn't care, played it for a goof. "You talk so sweet, ma chère. You should say it in French," which of course she always did. I asked Alex at least 5 times that summer if he and Misty were a thing. He denied it full. "Never laid a hand on her. She's like my sister. My girlfriend would kill me," etc. Never fucked her? That seemed highly unfucking likely. Something had happened between them. Sex, sure, but something else. Though what that was isn't obvious, even now that I'm older and DK wiser. Girls like Misty, of her class, were always orbiting around crore mongers like Alex, hoping that they would bite. Not that in the DR they ever did, but still. Once when I was going on about her, wondering why the fuck he hadn't jumped her, he looked around and then pulled me close and said, "You know the thing with her, right? Her dad used to fuck her until she was 12. Can you believe that?" "Her dad," I said. He nodded solemnly. "Her dad." Did I believe it? The incest? In the DR, incest was like the other national pastime. I guess I believed it as much as I believed Alex's whole "she's my sister" coro, which is to say, maybe I did and maybe I didn't. But in the end, I also didn't care. It made me feel terrible for her, sure, but it didn't make me want her any less. As for her and Alex, I never saw them touch, never saw anything that you could call calor pass between them. She seemed genuinely uninterested in him romantically, and that's why I figured I had a chance. "I don't want a boyfriend," she kept saying. "I want a visa." Dear, dear Misty. Beautiful and bitchy, and couldn't wait to be away from the DR. A girl who didn't let anyone push her around. Who once grabbed a Euro chick by the hair because the bitch tried to cut her in line. Wasn't really a deep person. I don't think I ever heard her voice an opinion about art or politics or say anything remotely philosophical. I don't think she had any female friends. Shit, I don't think she had any friends. Just a lot of people she said hi to in the clubs. Chick was as much a loner as I was. She never bought anything for anyone, didn't do community work, and when she saw children, she always stayed far away. Animales, she called them. And you could tell she wasn't joking. No, she wasn't anything close to humane. But at 19, who needed humane? She was buen moza and impossible, and when she laughed, it was like this little wilderness. I would watch her dance with Alex, with other guys. Never with me, I wasn't good enough. And my heart would break. And that was all that mattered. Around our 3rd week of hanging out, when the riots were beginning in the camps and the Haitians in the DR were getting deported over a freckle, I started talking about maybe staying for a few months extra. Taking a semester off Brown to keep my mom company, maybe volunteering in Haiti. Crazy talk, sure, but I knew for certain that I wasn't going to land Misty by sending her glips from 1,000 miles away. To bag a girl like that, you have to make a serious move, and staying in the DR was for me a serious move indeed. "I think I might stick around," I announced when we were all driving back from what was left of Las Terrenas. No baffler on the burner, and the heat was literally pulling our skin off. "Why would you do that?" Misty demanded. "It's awful here." "It's not awful here," Alex corrected mildly. "This is the most beautiful country in the world. But I don't think you'd last long. You're way gringo." "And you're what, Enriquillo?" "I know I'm gringo," Alex said, "but you're way gringo. You'd be running to the airport in a month." Even my mother was against it. Actually sat up in her medicine tent. You're going to drop school for what? Esa chica plástica? Don't be ridiculous, hijo. There's plenty of culo falso back home. That July, a man named Henri Casimir was brought into a field clinic attached to Chandamar. A former manager in the utility company, now reduced to carting sewage for the camp administration, brought in by his wife, Rosa, who was worried about his behavior. The last couple of months, Dude had been roaming about the camp at odd hours, repeating himself ad nauseam, never sleeping. His wife was convinced that her husband was not her husband. In the hospital that day, one Noni de Graaf, a Haitian epidemiologist and one of the few researchers who had been working on the disease since its first appearance. Brilliant and pretty much fearless, she was called the jet engine by her colleagues because of her headstrong ferocity. Intrigued by Casimir's case, she sat in on the examination. Casimir, apart from a low body temperature, seemed healthy. Blood work clean. No sign of virals or of the dreaded infection. When questioned, the patient spoke excitedly about a son he was claiming the following week. Distressed, Rosa informed the doctors that said son he was going on about had disbanded 2 months earlier. He had put his 50 renminbi faithfully into the pot every month, but just before his turn came around, they found out the whole thing was a setup. He never saw a penny, Rosa said. When Dr. de Graaf asked the wife what she thought might be bothering her husband, Rosa said simply, "Someone has witched him." Something about the wife's upset and Casimir's demeanor got Dr. de Graaf's antennas twitching. She asked Rosa for permission to observe Casimir on one of his rambles. Wife Rosa agreed. As per her complaint, Casimir spent almost his entire day tramping about the camp with no apparent aim or destination. Twice Dr. de Graaf approached him, and twice Casimir talked about the heat and about the sun he was soon to receive. He seemed distracted, disoriented even, but not mad. The next week, Dr. de Graaf tailed Casimir again. This time the good doctor discerned a pattern. No matter how many twists he took, invariably Casimir wound his way back to the vicinity of the quarantine zone at the very moment that the infected let out their infernal chorus. As the outburst rang out, Casimir paused and then, without any change in expression, ambled away. De Graaf decided to perform an experiment. She placed Casimir in her car and drove him away from the quarantine zone. At first, Casimir appeared normal, talking again about his son, wiping his glasses compulsively, etc. Then at half a mile from the zone, he began to show increasing signs of distress, twitching and twisting in his seat. His language became garbled. At the mile mark, Casimir exploded, snapped the seat bolt holding him in, and in his scramble from the car, struck de Graaf with unbelievable force, fracturing 2 ribs. Bounding out before the doctor could manage to bring the car under control, Casimir disappeared into the sprawl of Chandamar. The next day, when Dr. de Graaf asked the wife to bring Casimir in, he appeared to have no recollection of the incident. He was still talking about his son. After she had her ribs taped up, de Graaf put out a message to all medical personnel in the Haitian mission, inquiring about patients expressing similar symptoms. She assumed she would receive 4 or 5 responses. She received 214. She asked for workups. She got them. Sat down with her partner in crime, a Haitian-American physician by the name of Anton Leger, and started plowing through the material. Nearly all the sufferers had, like Casimir, shown signs of low body temperature, and so they performed temperature tests on Casimir. Sometimes he was normal, sometimes he was below, but never for long. A technician on the staff hearing about the case suggested that they requisition a thermal imager sensitive enough to detect minute temperature fluctuations. An imager was secured and then turned on Casimir. Bingo. Casimir's body temperature was indeed fluctuating, little tiny blue spikes every couple of seconds. Normal folks like de Graaf and Leger, they tested themselves naturally, scanned red, but patients with the Casimir complaint appeared on screen a deep flickering blue. On a lark, de Graaf and Leger aimed the scanner toward the street outside the clinic. They almost shot themselves. like for reals. Nearly one out of every eight pedestrians was flickering blue. The Graf remembers the cold dread that swept over her, remembers telling Leger, "We need to go to the infected hospital. We need to go there now." At the hospital, they trained their camera on the guarded entrance. Copies of those scans somehow made it to the outside, still chilling to watch. Every single person, doctor, assistant, aid worker, janitor, who walked in and out of that hospital, radiated blue. "We did what all kids with a lot of priv do in the DR. We kicked it. And since none of us had parents to hold us back, we kicked it super hard. Smoked ganja by the heap and tore up the Zona Colonial. And when we got bored, we left the dome for long looping curves from one end of the island to the other. The countryside, half abandoned because of the long drought, but still beautiful even in its decline." Alex had all these projects. Photos of all the prostitutes in the feria. Photos of every chimi truck in the Malecón. Photos of the tributes on the Conde. He also got obsessed with photographing all the beaches of the DR before they disappeared. "These beaches are what used to bring the world to us," he exclaimed. "They were the one resource we had." I suspect it was just an excuse to put Misty in a bathing suit and photograph her for 3 hours straight. Not that I was complaining. My role was to hand him cameras and afterward to write a caption for each of the selected shots he put on the wall. And I did. Just a little entry. The whole thing was called Notes from the Last Shore. Nice, right? I came up with that. Anyway, Misty spent the whole time on those shoots bitching about her bathing suits, about the scorch, about the mosquitoes that the bafflers were letting in, and endlessly warning Alex not to focus on her pipa. She was convinced that she had a huge one, which neither Alex nor I ever saw, but we didn't argue. "I got you, Cherie," was what he said. "I got you." After each setup, I always told her, "Tu eres guapísima." And she never said anything, just wrinkled her nose at me. Once, right before the fall, I must have said it with enough conviction, because she looked me in the eyes for a long while. I still remember what that felt like. Now it gets sketchy as hell. A lockdown was initiated, and the team of WHO docs attempted to enter the infected hospital in the quarantine zone. 9 went in, but nobody came out. Minutes later, the infected let out one of their shrieks, but this one lasted 28 minutes. And that, more or less, was when shit went Rwanda. In the DR, we heard about the riot, saw horrific videos of people getting chased down and butchered. 2 camera crews died, and that got Alex completely pumped up. "We have to go," he cried. "I'm missing it." "You're not going anywhere," Misty said. "But are you guys seeing this?" Alex said. "Are you seeing this?" That shit was no riot. Even we could tell that. All the relocation camps near the quarantine zone were consumed in what can only be described as a straight massacre. An outbreak of homicidal violence, according to the initial reports. People who had never lifted a finger in anger their whole lives, children, viejos, aid workers, mothers of 9, grabbed knives, machetes, sticks, pots, pans, pipes, hammers, and started attacking their neighbors, their friends, their pastors, their children, their husbands, their infirm relatives, complete strangers. Berserk, murderous, blood rage. No pleading with the killers or backing them down. They just kept coming and coming. Even when you pointed a Gauss gun at them. Stopped only when they were killed. Let me tell you, in those days, I really didn't know nothing. For real. I didn't know shit about women, that's for sure. Didn't know shit about the world, obviously. Certainly didn't know jack about the island. I actually thought me and Misty could end up together. Nice, right? The truth is I had more of a chance of busting a golden egg out my ass than I did of bagging a girl like Misty. She was from a familia de nombre. Wasn't going to have anything to do with a nadie like me. Un morenito from Villacón, whose mother had made it big selling hair straightening products to the Africanos. Wasn't going to happen. Not unless I turned myself white, or got a major league contract, or hit the fucking lottery. Not unless I turned into an Alex. And yet, you know what? I still had hope. Had hope that despite the world, I had a chance with Misty. Ridiculous hope, sure, but what do you expect? Nearly 200,000 Haitians fled the violence, leaving the possessed, as they became known, fully in control of the 22 camps in the vicinity of the quarantine zone. Misreading the situation, the head of the UN peacekeeping mission waited a full 2 days for tensions to cool down before attempting to reestablish control. Finally, two convoys entered the blood zone, got as far as Chandamar before they were set upon by wave after wave of the possessed and torn to pieces. Let me not forget this. This is the best part. 3 days before it happened, my mother flew to New Hialeah with my aunt for a specialty treatment. Just for a few days, she explained. And the really best part? I could have gone with her. She invited me, said, plenty of Kula Plastico in Florida. Can you imagine it? I could have ducked the entire fucking thing. I could have been safe. No one knows how it happened or who was responsible, but it took 2 weeks, 2 fucking weeks, for the enormity of the situation to dawn on the great powers. In the meantime, the infected, as refugees reported, sang on and on and on. On the 15th day of the crisis, advanced elements of the U.S. Rapid Expeditionary Force landed at Port-au-Prince. Drone surveillance proved difficult, as some previously unrecorded form of interference was disrupting the airspace around the camps. Nevertheless, a battle force was ordered into the infected areas. This force, too, was set upon by the possessed, and would surely have been destroyed to a man if helicopters hadn't been sent in. The possessed was so relentless that they clung to the runners, actually had to be shot off. The only upside? The glyphs the battle force beamed out finally got high command to pull their head out of their ass. The entire country of Haiti was placed under quarantine. All flights in or out canceled, the border with the DR sealed. An emergency meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was convened. The commander-in-chief pulled off his vacation, and within hours, a bomber wing scrambled out of Southern Command in Puerto Rico. Leaked documents showed that the bombers were loaded with enough liquid ass-kick to keep all of Port-au-Prince burning red-hot for a week. The bombers were last spotted against the full moon as they crossed the northern coast of the DR. Survivors fleeing the area heard their approach, and Dr. de Graaf, who had managed to survive the massacres and had joined the exodus moving east, chanced one final glance at her birth city just as the ordnance was sailing down. Because she was a God-fearing woman, and because she had no idea what kind of bomb they were dropping, Dr. de Graaf took the precaution of keeping one eye shut, just, you know, in case things got Sodom and Gomorrah, which promptly they did. The detonation event, no one knows what else to call it, turned the entire world white. 3 full seconds. Triggered a quake that was felt all across the island and also burnt out the optic nerve on Dr. de Graaf's right eye. But not before she saw it. Not before she saw them. Even though I knew I shouldn't, one night I went ahead anyway. We were out dancing in La Zona, and Alex disappeared after a pair of German chicks. "A Nazi cada año no te hace daño," he said. We were all out of our minds, and Misty started dancing with me. And you know how girls are when they can dance, and they know it. She just put it on me, and that was that. I started making out with her right there. I have to tell you, at that moment, I was so fucking happy, so incredibly happy. And then the world put its foot right in my ass. Misty stopped suddenly, said, "Do you know what? I don't think this is cool." "Are you serious?" "Yeah," she said. "We should stop." She stepped back from the longest, darkest song ever and started looking around. "Maybe we should get out of here. It's late." I said, "I guess I forgot to bring my locks with me." I almost said, "I forgot to bring your dad with me." "Hijo de la gran puta," Misty said, shoving me. And that was when the lights went out. Monitoring stations in the U.S. and Mexico detected a massive detonation in the Port-au-Prince area in the range of 8.3. Tremors were felt as far away as Havana, San Juan, and Key West. The detonation produced a second, more extraordinary effect, an electromagnetic pulse that deaded all electronics within a 600-square-mile radius. Every circuit of every kind shot to shit. In military circles, the pulse was called the Reaper. You cannot imagine the damage it caused. The bomber wing that had attacked the quarantine zone, dead, forced to ditch into the Caribbean Sea. No crew recovered. 32 commercial flights packed to summer peak capacity plummeted straight out of the sky. 4 crashed in urban areas. 1 pinwheeled into its receiving airport. Hundreds of privately owned sea craft lost. Servers down and power stations kaputted. Hospitals plunged into chaos. Even fat-line communicators thought to be impervious to any kind of terrestrial disruption began fritzing. The 3 satellites parked in geosync orbit over that stretch of the Caribbean went SUP too. Tens of thousands died as a direct result of the power failure. Fires broke out, seawalls began to fail, domes started heating up. But it wasn't just a simple one-time pulse. Vehicles attempting to approach within 600 miles of the detonation's epicenter failed. Communicators towed over the line could neither receive nor transmit. Batteries gave off nothing. This is what really flipped every motherfucker in the know inside out and back again. The Reaper hadn't just swung and run. It had swung and stayed. A dead zone had opened over a 600-mile chunk of the Caribbean. Midnight. No one knowing what the fuck was going on in the darkness. No one but us. Initially, no one believed the hysterical evacuees. 40-foot-tall cannibal motherfuckers running loose on the island? Negro, please. Until a set of soon-to-be iconic Polaroids made it out on one clipper, showing what later came to be called a Class 2 in the process of putting a slender, broken girl in its mouth. Beneath the photo, someone had scrawled, Numbers 11:18, Who shall give us flesh to eat? We came together at Alex's apartment first thing. All of us were wearing the same clothes from the night before. Watched the fires spreading across the sectors. Heard the craziness on the street. And with the bafflers down, felt for the first time on that roof the incredible heat rolling in from the dying seas. Misty pretending nothing had happened between us, me pretending the same. Your mom okay? I asked her, and she shrugged. She's up in the Cibao visiting family. The power's supposedly out there, too, Alex said. Misty shivered, and so did I. Nothing was working, except for old diesel burners and the archaic motos with no points or capacitors. People were trying out different explanations. An earthquake, a nuke, a Carrington event, the coming of the Lord. Reports arriving over the failing flatlines claimed that Port-au-Prince had been destroyed, that Haiti had been destroyed, that 13 million screaming Haitian refugees were threatening the borders, that Dominican military units had been authorized to meet the invaders, the term the Gov was now using, with ultimate force. And so, of course, what does Alex decide to do? Like an idiot, he decides to commandeer one of his father's vintage burners and take a ride out to the border. Just in case, you know, Alex said, packing up his Polaroid, something happens. And what do? Like even bigger idiots? Go with him.